Welcome back. Here we are. And this was a day, an election took place on Tuesday. Many things happened in this country. And we're going to reflect on what the meaning of that is for the future of politics in this nation. We're joined by Edward Wyckoff Williams, author, columnist, contributing editor to The Root. We're joined by Dr. Richard Vatz, professor of rhetoric. So I have the wrong title on here again. I'm sorry, Rick. But we'll get you right in a minute.
That's all right.
Professor at Towson State University.
I'm still a professor of rhetoric.
Yeah, you are. Blogger for Red Maryland and recently released book, The Only Authentic Book of Persuasion. And John Nichols, who's Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine, contributing writer for The Progressive and In These Times, and associate editor of The Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin, and co-author of Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America.
Before we begin, may I ask one question? What was wrong with Richard Nixon's victory in 1972?
Pardon?
You said you...
Let's get into this conversation. John Nichols, welcome. Good to have you with us.
It is a pleasure to be with you and your talkative guest.
And Edward will be here in a minute. But
oh, man.
So let's go through what happened yesterday. You've written some interesting things on about this. And there's a lot of let me just start with this. I think it's really interesting to look at this election of Chris Christie in New Jersey for just a moment, who won 30% of the African-American voters reported, I think, in Newark, New Jersey, who won this election. But there's been a lot of thought about what this really means and, A, why he won, how somebody who is a dyed-in-the-wool conservative can really kind of mask himself and kind of pull in these other votes. And others saying that, and they're also analyzing this as saying that his election really is not a harbinger of things to come for the Republican Party, because that's discounting the power of the Tea Party and the right and the power that they've established in the Republican Party. And they think Chris Christie is kind of the panacea and answer to that. And many people are arguing that's not the case.
Well, that is a very, very good multi-tiered question, Mark. And all the drivers around here are very impressed with it. I hate to rain on the media's parade.
Go ahead.
Usually we don't do that for 3 or 4 days after, but I will tell you that Chris Christie's victory is meaningless, irrelevant. It is a side story, a footnote to what happened on Tuesday, but it will get immense amounts of coverage for two reasons. Number one, an awful lot of our media loves to play a game of balance and to say, well, you see, it was a mixed result. We had a Democrat win one place, a Republican win someplace else. So we can't really take anything away from it. We can't analyze this election. That would be too complicated for us. So they just go to the theater of it. And in this case, Chris Christie is more than willing to present, more than willing to offer them the soundbites and the very long victory speech that that makes it possible to do that. But here's what's important to understand. Chris Christie had a unique and tragic incident occur on his watch. That was Hurricane Superstorm Sandy hitting the Jersey Shore, doing incredible damage to the state. And then, amazingly enough, in the recovery from Sandy, a horrible fire hit some of the best-known beach areas. And again, great tragedy, great trauma to the state. Christie did what any elected official with even baseline, sensibilities and sensitivity would. He went to the scene. He comforted people. He worked hard to make sure that the resources were there to do the recovery. He worked across lines of partisanship and ideology to advance that. That is what any sensible elected official would do. And then he set out to manipulate his reelection campaign to build on the goodwill that he had. And that's not, again, that's what any sensible elected official would do. But what did he do? He cut deals with Democrats in some regions of the state to get them to either stand down or actually back him for reelection.
Right.
He raised immense amounts of money so that he had a 6 or 7 to 1 spending advantage over his opponent. And he launched a $5 million tourism campaign on TV that featured him. Then he had a special election for the U.S. Senate that could have been scheduled to parallel the general election, but that would have brought out Democratic voters, so he scheduled it 3 weeks early. It was a manipulated, managed, quote-unquote, good result, and even with all that, he could only get the 60% of the vote. I cannot emphasize 1,000 times over the extent to which Chris Christie will be, at best, a flash in the pan if he seeks to run for the presidency. I see him very much as the President Rudy Giuliani of the 2016 campaign.
Interesting. Rick Vatz.
Well, except that he wouldn't enter into a national race late. I think he has better instincts than Rudy Giuliani. But I do think that the exigencies that play to a person's winning a particular race tend to mislead people into believing that it's a long-term popularity. I do think that Christie has much better, if I may use a misplaced metaphor, much better legs than Giuliani. I do think that you're correct that he has played those particular exigencies of recency, as is true historically with politicians, that when they are lucky or unlucky enough to have local tragedies, and using Tip O'Neill's statement that all politics is local, I think it redounds to their benefit. And also, Buono was a very weak opponent. I think that enters into it. The fact that the Democrats kind of conceded the election to him, I think that has an effect. So I wouldn't be as dour about his future. I think we just don't know. But I do think that we are exaggerating his future per his victory yesterday.
Well, let me – but you know, one of the things about
– Tuesday.
On Tuesday, I'm sorry. Yeah. So I mean, but there's so much also to this election with Christie winning, and of course, Democrats did not field a strong opponent and didn't push the campaign. Right. But it was also Christie who made the decision to make sure that the elections were divided, so that Booker didn't run the same day he did, so that Booker would not kind of get the Democratic forces out en masse to oppose him. So
right. That
was kind of a very kind of all Democrats and Republicans do this, but these kind of very sneaky political moves to remain in power.
Right.
Which clearly
and it cost the taxpayers of New Jersey $25 million.
On top of that, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, and also, you know, there is a great deal of ambivalence among Republicans with respect to Christie, given his kind of abdication of his role in the Romney campaign, which he did not need to do in the presidential election. So I think that in the height of victory, I think that there are an awful lot of people that want to claim victory as their child, and they're overly optimistic about Christie, and I don't see it. But I do not see the argument that he is there for a flash in the pan. I think that's too far on the other side.
So I'm curious what you both think about, and I'm curious, folks, join us here 410-319-8888, and I want to hear your thoughts on these elections and where you think that what these meant. Some of you, especially living in Virginia, I'm curious to see what you think about the election that just happened down there. And what does that election mean in the face of what's happening nationally? There are people, I think, John, that are looking at the closeness, the tightness of this election, in Virginia with Cuccinelli coming, just losing by 3 points. The fact that many people look at McAuliffe as, many people, especially in the progressive world, look at McAuliffe as kind of a shyster on some levels. and that this election really says more about where the future battles may be going in America than any of the other elections. But we'll talk about the city elections in a moment. But what are your thoughts on that?
Let's begin with Virginia for a little bit. And I kind of have to object to your characterization of Terry McAuliffe as a shyster.
Okay, that's fine.
In fairness, I think that there are a lot of shysters who are, you know, relatively honorable people.
That's true. I would acquiesce to that.
And so I kind of, you know, I think that McAuliffe really defines a new word unto himself. And you know, here's a guy who was a Democratic fundraiser who had never held public office. His entire qualification is that he knew how to raise a lot of money. And then when he raised a lot of money, when he wasn't actually, you know, managing campaigns and things like that, he was setting up business deals with the people he raised money from. And so if the term crony capitalism has a face, it's probably Terry McAuliffe, for better or worse. And the fact is that he was a Democratic candidate instead of a Republican is kind of amusing. It suggests a lot more about our political parties, perhaps, than many people would want to recognize. But let's put that aside because everybody in Virginia did. And let's look at the reality of that race. That race was affected by three national factors. And one of the reasons is Virginia is a suburb of federal power. Virginia is where a huge number of people, not just Washington, D.C. employees, but shipyard workers and naval retirees and all sorts of other folks have various ties to the federal government. And that's been changing Virginia because it's brought in a lot more, I'd be fair to say, liberal folks, especially in Northern Virginia. The three factors that I think were in play. First, the Republican Party of Virginia, which was once very much a managerial party. They got power and they ran things, you know, in a relatively business-friendly way. But basically, their purpose was to, you know, have power and keep it. Has in Virginia become really arguably one of the three or four most extreme political parties in the Republican state level on social issues. And they pioneered vaginal ultrasound, put that word into our dialogue. And that alone is a pretty good argument on the part of a lot of people to look for alternatives. But they then nominated, having already identified themselves as very, very extreme on social issues, they then nominated three candidates for statewide office who are actually more extreme than their own base. And so that became a huge factor, very, very damaging. It's one of the reasons why Ken Cuccinelli, throughout the latter stages of the campaign, was never ahead of the polls. Even when he got close, he never got ahead. Secondly, you had the shutdown, Ted Cruz. I think that gave the Democrats a stunning boost in early to mid-October. Then you had the Obamacare problem, which I think gave the Democrats a little bit of a burden, not certainly as much as national press was talking about. So those are your three national factors that weighed into the race. The final thing I'll say, though, is the most important thing in this race was a third-party candidate, the Libertarian, who got almost 7% of the vote, a young guy who is a lawyer, I believe, in a biracial marriage former tech guy who was out on the West Coast. In fact, almost everything about the Libertarian candidate skewed sort of young, hip, cool, appealing. And he ran with a heavy emphasis on his support for marriage equality, his opposition to the extreme social right-wing policies of the Republicans, a little bit of criticism of the Democrats on some economic issues, but not so much. And if you look at the crosstab for the exit polls, what you will see is that Terry McAuliffe bled a lot of support to the Libertarian. Almost 20% of people under the age of 30 voted for the Libertarian. In urban areas, the Libertarian did better. That's off balance. Among well-educated folks, among people in certain income, higher level income, the Libertarian did better. I can't emphasize to you the extent to which I think the Libertarian candidate actually harmed Terry McAuliffe at the end of the race.
That's interesting. Let me just ask you this.
I haven't heard that.
John, I really want to push this a little tad further before Rick comes back in real fast. A lot of common wisdom, Frank Rich's piece and the New Yorker yesterday and other places, was just the opposite, saying they thought that the Libertarian 7%, if it had not been there, McAuliffe would have lost. But you're seeing it in a different way.
Sometimes you got to look at the data. And all I'm telling you is there is a easy sensibility among a lot of political commentators who think that Libertarians always take votes from Republicans. And
right.
I'll emphasize, they do take votes from Republicans. I think there are many cases last year where Libertarian candidates actually streamed off a significant amount of Republican support and ended up helping Democrats. In the Virginia case, though, if you look at where Robert Sarvis, the Libertarian candidate's votes were coming from, I see a lot of evidence, especially among those young voters, voters under the age of 30, which is roughly, 10-12% of the electorate, where I don't think they were voting for him as an alternative to Ken Cuccinelli. I think they were voting for him as an alternative to Terry McAuliffe.
And to the establishment.
I'm not an expert on Virginia politics, but let me just point out some things that I think when counter to that analysis. First of all, McAuliffe won by something like 2.5%, and he was and the polls showed him ahead by an average of 7% days going into the race. So I think there's also an issue as to whether the polls motivated people to vote in one way or another. And also, there are some claims out there, and I don't know whether they're accurate or not, that there was a bundler from McAuliffe that supported Sarvis's campaign. Now, I don't know the
that did
the,
what?
That supported Sarvis's campaign, in other words, to take votes away from Cuccinelli. You know, and you know, who I don't know whether that's true or not, but there it's out there, and I think that in the end, there was a rhetorical fight, and that is the race about the shutdown or is it about Obamacare? And a lot of times, you come down to these rhetorical fights as to what an election is about. What is the salient issue?
So, and let me, we have to take a quick break here. When we come back, I want to pick up on that point. And because I want to look at the elections on Tuesday as we conclude this conversation to in terms of what happened in the mayoral elections in Boston, in Seattle, in Harrisburg, in New York City, and the election in Virginia, and whether it wasn't so much what you called salient issues, Rick, or whether it was something much deeper that's dividing America. Part of it's in urban America, part of it's progressive versus people holding on to what I would consider the past in many ways, and see if there isn't a much deeper divide going on here that is emblematic of what's coming next. And we'll delve into that when we come back. A little Al Hurt, that's Java. Of course, he was born on this day and celebrate a little bit of Al Hurt's music. Was not really one of my very favorite musicians, but I like his stuff. He was a good straight-ahead guy. Reminding you here that to come to our Monday night town hall meeting at 6:30 at the Creative Alliance at the Patterson Theater. We are going to have a conversation about the state of the arts in our education system. We're bringing together parents, students, educators, and others to develop strategies about putting arts back in our schools and the role they play in the lives of our children. The program will conclude a jam session led by area student musicians as well. That'll be this coming Monday, November the 11th, 6:30 p.m. Great pizza parlor right across the street and a restaurant inside. And get some food at the Creative Alliance at the Patterson. More information at 443-885-4591 or at weaa.org. And I'll be moderating that panel here for WEAA, so it'll be a good one.
Good.
Not that because I'm moderating. It's going to be a good panel because of all the people we have coming on.
Shinarka, let me ask about the 1972 election, why you think that was a bad decision.
That's one of our guests, Dr. Rick Vatz. Rick Vatz is professor of rhetoric and communication at Towson University's Department of Instructional Leadership and Professional Development, blogger for Red Maryland, and author of the recently released The Only Authentic Book of Persuasion. And I always want to know how the right wing got hold of the word red and took it over. I don't know that either. John Nichols is with us, Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine, contributing writer for The Progressive and In These Times, and the associate editor of The Capital Times, the daily newspaper of Madison, Wisconsin, where he lives and was raised, and co-author of Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. And let me just pick up, gentlemen. Folks, you can join us here at 410-319-8888 with what I left off with, which was what this election might be saying that is fundamentally deeper than just any individual issue, John Nichols, that people can throw at an election.
Absolutely. And I think that's the most important thing to do, to step back from the personalities and the individual races, because the fact is that we have, over the last 30 years, have had an increasingly nationalized politics. True that Tip O'Neill did say all politics is local, but Tip O'Neill passed away a long time ago. And the truth of the matter is that as our media has tended to stand down at the local and state level, we get more and more of our cues regarding politics from national news, from national development. And also, I think in some cases, we default to our core concerns, perhaps even better than we used to. And the one thing to take away from the 2013 election cycle is the sweeping rejection of austerity cuts as an answer to the problems of the United States. In New Jersey, Chris Christie got 60% of the vote. Raising the minimum wage by a dollar and indexing it to inflation for the future, putting that in the state constitution, got 61% of the vote. So many he also voted for a substantial and ongoing minimum wage increase. Mm-hmm. Out in Washington State, in the Seattle suburb of SeaTac, which is where their main airport is, they voted to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. And there are now proposals, the new mayor of Seattle even, talking about the possibility of, or at least entertaining, a massive increase in the minimum wage in that city. Across the country, you see similar patterns. In Cincinnati, voters rejected a plan to gut out the public employee and public teacher pensions that had been pushed as, you know, a necessary austerity measure. They recognized, no, this is just people trying to take money away from public employees. And we see results like this across the country. In Boston, they attacked Marty Walsh, one of the mayoral candidates,
right,
for being too close to the union. After they attacked him for that, he started moving up in the polls. Bill de Blasio in New York, a guy who came out of the union progressive anti-austerity community, overwhelming 50-point win in the mayoral race. And I just cannot emphasize to you that if there's one constant across the United States from Tuesday night, it is that people really are not happy with the idea of a future that is defined by cuts and cuts and cuts. They would much prefer a future that is defined by growth and jobs.
Rick.
Yeah, I just don't find them mutually exclusive. I mean, what kind of cuts are you talking about? I mean, it seems to me that if there's a wave of the future, and we probably don't disagree on this, it is more and more that people want government to take care of them, and there's more and more dependency, and the fact is that you know, as you have a population that has been expanded by Democrats to include younger and younger people, and when you have efforts to make part of the electorate poorer and poorer people, you know, you end up getting ultimately working majorities in various locations to try to maximize the extent to which government and therefore people with money will have an income redistribution. And I think this is going to redound. You know, there's the is and the ought. You know, I don't think I disagree with the is. The ought, I think this is long-term devastating for the economy. And I think that ultimately the country will be worse off for it. But it is the is. That doesn't mean it is what it is, which I think is a dumb expression. But I think that's the wave of the future.
Well, let me take off from those wise words with a total agreement. I think there is a growing class of people who are looking. I may change a couple of the adverbs and adjectives, but basically this concept. I think there is a growing class of people in this country who are looking to government to be more of a force. And they recognize that with free trade laws and other initiatives, our corporations are more than willing to abandon the United States except to get their corporate bailout. And so folks are looking for something. And I think there are locations where you have developed a permanent voting class that supports having the government have a much bigger hand and even some redistribution of the wealth. Some of these places are Germany, which has one of the most booming economies in the world. Sweden, which has an incredibly successful economy. In fact, frankly, if you look around the world, the countries that are, in many cases, showing some of the best economic returns at this time, far better circumstances than that of the United States, are countries that have recognized that the government is not the enemy of growth and jobs and of freedom and of an ability for people to live fuller and better lives. It can be a part of the process.
Yeah, when you look at how people are trying to, when you look at,
I'm sorry,
go ahead.
Finish. We've had 30 years in the United States of the fantasy that government is the problem. And I just think people have heard it. They actually experimented with it. They let that fantasy be played out. They've seen how successful it is. And now they're looking for something more rational.
Yeah, it's just when you look at the unemployment and the actual unemployment rate in the United States, and the underemployment situation, and a lot of it is due to the fact that people are trying to avoid the health care insurance costs. I mean, you just cannot I can't remember Maggie Thatcher's famous remark now, but you just cannot redistribute wealth to the point of increasing it. And the United States is going to be worse off, and we already were worse off with the unbelievable persistent underemployment and unemployment that we have, and the fact that the youth can't get jobs, the fact that we're just trying to have youth pay for the elderly, the increased cost of Medicare, Medicaid. I think that this is a game which in 5 to 10 years will become undeniable, just as President Obama's claims for Obamacare ultimately became undeniable. Where he said that you can keep your plan if it hasn't you can keep your plan if you like your plan, you can keep it, and now he's changed it to you can keep your plan if it hasn't changed since the law was passed. That's what he said.
I'm going to stipulate on that one and say that as a supporter of single payer Medicare for all health care, I'm no fan of Obamacare. I think it gives away far too much money to corporations. I think it was defined by the industries that have cost us so much money and given us so little in quality care. And so I'm with you. I think the president bowed to the right, and in many ways, Obamacare is, I hope, one of the last playouts of this fantasy that government shouldn't do things and it ought to be done by the private sector. If we step forward, though, and recognize that we go off what you're saying about this dependency class and Margaret Thatcher, I'm not British. I'm an American. And so I tend to quote American presidents, and I'll go with Dwight Eisenhower, who said that the United States will be much better off if our wealthy contribute substantially into making our communities, our states, our nation work, and also that if we set our priorities at the level of the working person, the people who need stuff, rather than at the level of the wealthy person and the elite. And so I'm an Eisenhower guy. You're a Thatcher guy. I respect that.
You're not an Eisenhower guy. You're a selective quote Eisenhower guy. Maggie Thatcher said, her famous quote was, "The problem with socialism is that eventually you run out of other people's money." And the fact is that, you know, if you look at Obamacare as just kind of a synecdoche, and you look at all the, you know, we've stopped talking about what's covered in Obamacare, and if you look at what's covered in Obamacare, everything is covered in Obamacare.
Let's not divert into this other conversation about mental health care right now, please, Vance.
Mark, I'm telling you that historically, when you eliminate that from the conversation, you eliminate a major component, which is which is revelatory of government power and government takeover.
Right.
I'm enthusiastic for my co-guest description. I just fear that that's not where we're headed. The fact of the matter is, companies are going to get richer. Hospitals and doctors are going to get richer. Obamacare was, in my opinion, badly, badly designed. But the bad design was that we didn't borrow from national health care plans around the world that worked very, very well, reducing costs and getting lots of care to the people.
That worked at
making sure the insurance companies do okay.
We forget the insurance companies, others wrote this bill. I mean, I came up with it.
Absolutely.
I'll be presenting tonight in a panel I'll be on about where the healthcare is going in America. Just several examples. There's a company called Epic.
Yep.
That runs all the computer systems. It runs computer systems that and software for doctors and offices and hospitals. Well, the woman who owns that company helped design the plan.
And can I just tell you, Mark, that while I've been very, very critical of these private sector firms, I can't criticize Epic because they're headquartered in the Madison area and have added thousands of jobs. I'm sure that whatever they did was noble. The fact of the matter is, yeah, it's actually probably one of the best examples that I could give you. There's a private sector company got involved in the process and now has added thousands of jobs.
That also is making billions of dollars of profits off of doctors and hospitals that weren't necessary.
Like Obamacare might not be quite the drag that some people describe.
Mark, I know you don't want me to talk.
We're going to wrap it up here, so go finish up. Rick, and then John, final thoughts.
I just wanted to make a point about Obamacare. I mean, just one thing. The fact is that counseling is part of Obamacare. How can that be a medical cost? In other words, if you and your wife don't get along and you seek counseling, That's part of Obamacare.
Well, I think it is. As it should be. This is part of therapy. I'm sorry you're wrong, but that's okay because you don't understand mental illness. It's not your problem. John, final thought.
My final thought is that the media got Tuesday all wrong. The interesting story is not Chris Christie.
Right.
The interesting story is Bill de Blasio. I don't know if he's going to succeed. He has set an incredible goal to address income inequality in one of the most unequal cities in America. But that is the fascinating issue and political story.
He's a crazy left guy. And the fact New York elected him.
So he might actually succeed.
And we'll see. I mean, I think these mayors that have won in places like Seattle and Boston and in especially de Blasio in New York, we'll see where that takes things. I mean, it's gonna be very interesting to watch. And I want to thank both of you for being with Rick Fatz. Always great to have you. Thank
great
you so much.
Thank you,
John Nichols. Always great to have you as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and I love my co-guest.
You're a
I
good guy.
Him again.
you will both be back together. Thank you.
All right, Ben.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to look at this failed war on drugs. What comes next? Stay with us.
Don't criticize it.